It was just 5 days ago that the latest national climate assessment was released by the federal government. And as you've heard by now, there's plenty in there about how climate change is affecting us now. Our guest this hour can speak to that very issue. Rather than write 1,600 pages of general material, as in the assessment, Lauren Oakes focused on a single tree species. The yellow cedar gets the close-up treatment in Lauren's book, In Search of the Canary Tree, the story of a scientist, a cypress, and a changing world. Lauren Oakes is a conservation scientist at the Wildlife Conservation Society. She's also an adjunct professor teaching earth system science at Stanford. She splits her time between California and Montana. Lauren Oakes, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you all, so thank you for having me.
Sure. Given the rich trove of conservation subjects in California and Montana, how'd you end up studying Alaska?
I actually lived in Alaska for a bit before my PhD research, and I worked in conservation there. And actually, when I started my PhD, I was looking to do a project in Brazil, and I actually really wanted to go back to a place where I had worked to some extent before and work in a different ecosystem and take a look at... In the north, warming's happening twice as fast as many other parts of the planet or the averages. So it was attractive for me from a standpoint on climate change to kind of look at where the impacts are already quite extreme.
Yeah, that's interesting when you point out that as you get closer to the polar regions, the changes are more dramatic. So why this tree, though, as a demonstration of that?
Yeah, so it's all about vulnerabilities, right? And this is something that I talk about in the book, that there is potentially, you know, a threshold for any species, right, where we hit some kind of climate tipping point that can put us at our limits. And, you know, that's a question I think I've struggled with and we're all struggling with in terms of humanity, but I looked at from the standpoint of one species. So this yellow cedar tree has been dying because of climate change. Climate change plays a factor in a vulnerability that it already has. And in some ways, it was, as a scientist, it was interesting to me to look at a species where we knew the link to climate change already. We knew what the threshold was. We knew how it was already being impacted. And I wanted to look at how does the rest of the environment and the people in that area then respond to those changes. So that was the main appeal to me as a scientist. But then philosophically, it became interesting to me in my writing in terms of, okay, well, what can I learn from this? If we have this question about, you know, what's a threshold for humanity, are there lessons from this tree and from the people and the communities that are coping with its loss that can apply to our own lives elsewhere?
Truly an indicator, like a canary in a coal mine.
Yeah.
So I noticed that you point out in the book people don't even agree on what the tree should be called, and you call it Calotropis nutcatensis, and I've noticed it also called Camicyprus nutcatensis. What's going on there?
Yeah, so there is, both in the common name and in the botanical name, there's been a long debate. Actually, in one of my aspects of fact-checking, I remember, I think it was a 26 email series from different botanists around the world who will debate which genus it's in. So it has changed over time, and it's currently Calotropis. Anyhow, but it's also had a number of common names, so people in British Columbia might know it more as from Nootka Sound, where it was originally documented. But in Alaska, it's known best as a yellow cedar. And what I say is, a name is just a name, but what really mattered to me was that this really beautiful, long-lived species is dying in a warming world, and what are the potential impacts of that, and what can we learn from that?
It likes it cold and wet, it would appear. I noticed that the range does it looks like it extends all the way down into the Oregon Cascades. Do you know of specimens there?
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually, there's been some document in the northern tip of California, and it runs up through the Pacific coast into Prince William Sound. That's kind of the last edge of the contiguous distribution. And, of course, you know, there are questions now. So the species is under review for the Endangered Species Act. But, you know, the areas where it's affected by the decline is in British Columbia and up in Alaska. But in parts of California, or Northern California and down into Oregon, you'll see, you know, healthy trees, as well as in parts of Southeast Alaska and British Columbia, you know, despite the impacts of climate change.
All right, so it's not like they're all dying, but
like they're all dying.
Okay,
right.
But mentioned there's quite a dramatic moment right in the front of the book when you saw the dead trees from the air. Talk about what you saw versus what you expected to see.
Yeah, so my first time, I mean, I'd read about them. It obviously became interesting to me as a topic. I was committed to doing research on it, but I was I basically hadn't experienced it and lived it yet. And my first, the book opens with my first flight in a small Cessna plane over the landscape. And you'll just see these massive patches of dying trees. And I guess at the time I was thinking about what it was our study protocol is going to be, how are we going to set up stands and set up plots and, you know, measure trees and how are we going to randomly sample and all these kind of scientific approaches. But, you know, what struck me personally in that moment was just how massive it was. And that idea, again, that every species has a threshold. So I was, you know, flying over looking at one, thinking about, you know, what is the human threshold as well.
Right. And so that gives us a chance to widen the focus for a second, because I wanted to ask you, how dramatic are some of the other signs of climate change you you noticed while you were in Alaska?
Oh, sure. So, I mean, there's a whole range of impacts, whether you're talking about coastal erosion that's obviously affecting communities much farther north, changes in stream flow, water that can affect, you know, fish populations, but also human populations in terms of water access or depending on what kind of energy production they're using, they may rely upon water for that as well. Obviously, I think the other, you know, canary in terms of early climate change communications has been glaciers, looking at glacier retreat. But this one to me was profoundly different because there's a long history of human connection to these trees. So people in the region have used them for thousands of years in cultural practices. There's a long history of cultural reverence. And then also today, they're one of the most economically valuable trees. And in the past, they've been exported to other parts of the world. There's an interest in them in Japan because there's a...
Much more to talk about Lauren Oakes. Her book is called In Search of the Canary Tree. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Lauren in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest today is Lauren Oakes, who is a conservation scientist at the Wildlife Conservation Society. She put together a doctoral dissertation about yellow cedar trees in Alaska and how climate change is affecting them. They are dying in great numbers. She put out a book for us published officially yesterday. The book is called In Search of the Canary Tree, the story of a scientist, a cypress, and a changing world. It's a conversation you're welcome to join here on the Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to back up a few years before your time, Lauren, to get the Aldo Leopold quote you bring in here, where he talked about if you're going to work in conservation science, you're working in a world of wounds. What does that mean?
Yeah, it means essentially the more that we learn, the more we are struggling with in terms of awareness of the problems we're facing. So he said that long ago, but it's even becoming more pressing today, I think, for a broader public in terms of climate change. So it's that feeling, if you believe in climate change and you understand it's going to be affecting your life, it's this feeling of helplessness, what can I do about it, that I think many of us are struggling with.
You point out the huge amount of work for your doctoral dissertation, but that wasn't enough. I mean, how big was the dissertation, by the way, in pages? I'm curious.
Yeah, oh, that's a good question. I think it's around 280, maybe.
Okay.
So then I wrote another 200 and some for the book. But in a very different way, I will say, a very different way. Can I emphasize that anymore?
Yes, it's a lot of narrative and a lot of dialogue in here. It's a real human kind of book. It's not just a horticulturist's look at the yellow cedar. But you had a bigger story to tell then, obviously, from what you could tell in your dissertation.
Yeah, so for me, the big moment was my defense day, actually. I had kind of felt along the way throughout my research that there was a story here. There could be a book. But everybody talks about the day you get your PhD as this major relief, this feeling of accomplishment. And I certainly felt some relief the moment they called me doctor for the first time. But I also just felt that there was still something incomplete for me. And I kind of struggled at the time with what was the next thing I was going to do. It didn't feel quite right to be jetting off to study another forest impacted by climate change. There were certainly ideas I had. Joshua Tree was another one of interest to me. As a scientist, that seemed like the thing I should do. But what felt unresolved to me was kind of more of this question of how do you live with what you know and how do you have hope about the future? I felt like, the more knowledgeable I became about not only the species and ecosystem, but the impacts of climate change in general, forced me to, you know, struggle with that question and really want to find resolution for it. So I say in the book, if, you know, writing is an act of discovery, that's what it became for me, because I still had that to work through.
Well, in fact, you're not the first scientist, certainly, to look at the overall trends in warming and say it's too late. And I get that, particularly when you have, you know, assessment after assessment plopping in front of us, like the one last week that says, hey, you know, we're feeling the effects already. It's not like we can stop climate change. I mean, maybe we can reverse it ultimately or slow it down,
right.
But it's here. And so back to what the question that you just posed to yourself, how do you live with what you know? How do you?
Yeah. So I think, one aspect of it is realizing that there's still so much we can do. I'm pretty frustrated by the fact that I think a lot of the dialogue out there is this doom and gloom perspective, and that has been effective, you know, in the past, and maybe to some extent today still in raising awareness. There was a recent poll by a political scientist at Stanford. It found about 74% of Americans believe our temperatures are rising, and a large percentage of those believe it's caused by climate change. And that's not actually that divided between Republicans and Democrats, just by what we think. So in my opinion, we're there. We're reaching this high level of awareness. But that also has come with a lot of sense of, you know, fear or even apathy. Will it affect me? So for me, I think there's a lot we can do, and part of my writing the book was trying to inspire that question in others. What will be your canary and what's within your own power? Maybe that's something small in terms of addressing your home energy use. Maybe if you're, you know, a leader in a corporation that's taking on different actions rather than waiting for something from the top down. So that's the mitigation side, right? But then the adaptation side, I think that we can all do our part of learning what's happening in our own communities, and also starting to reach out and help those that are going to be more impacted than others. You know, the wildfires are a great example of that.
Oh, they are indeed. Lauren Oakes is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is In Search of the Canary Tree, the story of a scientist, a cypress, and a changing world. Let's talk about some of the people you met along the way to doing the research in Alaska into the yellow cedar. A lot of guys named Paul, but let's at least give credit to Paul Hennen. Why is his work so important?
Yeah, so that is true. I say in the book there are many Pauls, and you'd go crazy if I just called them all Paul in the book. And how many Pauls could we have in Southeast Alaska that are working on this tree? But there were a fair number of them, so they have nicknames throughout the book. But the first and foremost one is Dr. Paul Hennen, and he was a researcher at the U.S. Forest Service. He recently retired, but he spent 30 years of his full career studying, but trying to address the question of what was killing the trees. It actually started as his PhD research, and it was not an easy one to resolve. So he was the one who led many initiatives and collaborated with other scientists to eventually figure out what it was. And when I met him first in 2010, he was just about to publish a synthesis that showed quite clearly what those vulnerabilities were and how climate change was affecting them. So for me, that was a really strong bouncing off point to ask what happens next, because a lot of times we're still trying to figure out, well, what's the climate link? Can you describe the vulnerabilities? Or maybe this is a probability of a certain event happening that's, you know, more likely because of climate change.
You know, he really knows the long story. And how long have yellow cedars been living in that part of Alaska by anybody's best estimate?
Oh, gosh, how long have they been living? That's a good one. I mean, these trees will live up to a couple thousand years. I haven't seen one that old. Most of the ones in the areas where I was working were on the order of 400 to 600 years, although I've seen some that are probably over 1,000. And then some of the earliest observations of the dying trees were actually made by explorers in the area in the early 1900s, and it was in the late latter part of the century, the 70s and 80s, that we saw a real peak. So the thought there is actually that they established during cooler times, mm-hmm. and then climate change has exacerbated what was, you know, probably already a certain vulnerability based on when they established and how the climate was changing.
Which is always really fascinating to me, particularly when we talk about trees and their ability to regenerate or not in ecosystems that have changed because we live in them. And the idea that you couldn't get the same kind of forest today if you tried to plant the same sort of thing, the one that's standing there now would not be able to regenerate in a lot of cases because the tree is uniquely adapted to certain kinds of conditions that don't necessarily exist any longer. For the yellow cedar, the first reason on their list would appear to be that they're not getting enough snow. How does that work?
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny story or a little bit of a counterintuitive one in terms of climate change because they're actually affected by freezing in the long term and a loss of snow. So freezing impacts in a warming world sounds a bit confusing, but I'll walk you through it.
Right.
So in the Pacific Northwest, what we're seeing and you're living is an increase in precipitation as rainfall and tends to be a decrease in snowfall. And in Southeast Alaska, in the springtime, the trees are now dehardening earlier, and you still get a lot of sudden cold events. So if you're up in Southeast in March, it's not uncommon to see, you know, a few days where a cold front comes in from the interior or from the coast. And it's in that window that the tree's root structures are damaged. They have really shallow root structures and they tend to be found in kind of wet, boggy soils. And so without snow acting as an insulator, snow is basically like a blanket on their roots. They are then vulnerable to these sudden, persistent cold events.
So it's the wet cold they can handle then with the snow on their roots, but the drier cold with the roots exposed doesn't work for them.
Yeah, losing snow is kind of the main factor.
Huh. All right. We're talking to Lauren Oakes about her book, In Search of the Canary Tree, the story of a scientist, a cypress, and a changing world. You're welcome to join the conversation on the exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We had three calls. We got one now. Let's go to Carter in Wolf Creek. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I have just listened a few times to this most recent climate report, the last time I listened to it, they were specifically talking about what the report had to say to the Northwest, and I found it almost terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Raising the anxiety level here quite high, and I'm in my mid 70s now, and in 1970 I was in the Bay Area walking with a young woman in a young adult conference, and we were very concerned about the future then. So I've been thinking about this for a long time. So what does your guest there have to say about what this most recent climate report has to say pointedly to the Northwest?
And what to do if we're terrified, I guess, is another good place to go. Thank you for that, Carter. Thoughts from you, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, it is a startling report when you go through and you read the impacts. And I think that there's a certain level of taking in that information and figuring out how we're going to cope with it, for sure, that I sense as well. Some of the, you know, highlights have been, gosh, impacts to the economy, human health, agriculture, water resources. And again, I kind of point my more optimistic outlook to the local level to say, in our communities, what resources are we relying upon? Where are we getting our water? Where does our food come from? How might we be impacted, but also how might we be able to change our use patterns? Maybe that means developing new kinds of, you know, relationships with other communities where we source things differently. Those are the types of kind of small-scale actions that I look towards. as a place where we can take action, and as a place where we might not feel so helpless.
So to counter the idea that it's too big, I can't do anything about it. Yeah, you can do little things, and those can help.
Yeah, and also focusing, I think, when you read these reports, again, they are. You're right. There's a regional assessment to it, but a lot of times we're looking at a summary of information, and what's happening in our very own local community may be different. Philosophically, I think I draw, and I've struggled with this question, and I've thought about it in terms of what I've learned from the tree, really, and that, you know, despite the large-scale impacts to this species, there were still places where there are surviving trees and where they are thriving, even in a stand impacted by climate change. You know, not all the trees die. So scientifically, that was interesting to me. It maybe speaks to microclimate. We don't know exactly why. But philosophically, I also think about it in terms of the human impacts. Like, there will be places where we can thrive. I want to believe that, and I do.
Okay, so let's come back to the tree, because you write in the book about wanting to create a chrono sequence to tell the story of the tree's decline. How does a chrono sequence work?
Yeah, so chrono sequence is a process, is a method used by ecologists to study phenomenons that occur over a long period of time. So they've been used to study how sand dunes develop or how soils in the Hawaiian Islands, for example. And it's the idea that a longitudinal study would just be too difficult, right? So I could choose a forest, set up a plot or a site, measure the trees, and wait 10, 20, 30, 40 years for climate change to do what it's going to do, or I could use this method. So basically what I did was select sites, a series of sites along the coast that had been affected at different points of time. So some of the trees were standing like telephone poles on the landscape. A lot of time had passed in order for them to decay, even after their death. But then there were sites where the trees had just been affected recently, and maybe the foliage was brown or recently dead. And by measuring a series of sites in the same way, as well as having a healthy comparison, then you're able to infer a process of what happens after the trees die.
You certainly relied on not just scientific stuff, but things in a bunch of other fields of interest. The famous photographs of Edward Muybridge got into the discussion.
Yeah, it's certainly. Again, it's kind of my play on both scientific method, but then also philosophically thinking about what can I do to play a part of the solution. And there was a person I met, Greg Streveler. He's a naturalist in Southeast Alaska, who lives in Gustavus. He's done a lot of research in the area and is perhaps one of the most knowledgeable in terms of observing changes. And he was someone who pushed me from the beginning with my study, basically saying a lot of scientists will come and just monitor species to extinction. Is that what you're going to do, or is there more meaning here? And he said that a lot of knowledge and potentially impact, positive impact, can come from standing still in place and observing over time, that you then see something different. So that's where Muybridge comes in, because he set up the camera in one place and was able to figure out did the horse's legs ever hit the ground, really only by standing in one place and observing over time.
It is funny to think that Muybridge actually did that, I think in part to settle an argument. And didn't he collect a prize for it? I mean, sort of like the X Prize of the day?
I think so. I'm not quite sure what the prize was, but I think there was an award for that one.
Just to prove that horses actually do get all 4 feet off the ground.
Yeah,
when
yeah. It is true.
So it's a great where science has come in the years. So, you know, here again, that we have all these scientific gadgets, and you get into all of the terminology. You got clearly elbow deep in data, and the rest of us are just sort of hanging back with terms like diameter at breast height. But it gets down to something beyond the data. And as you point out, the trees can tell us things that the weather stations can't. Like what?
Well, I think in the end, twofold. On the ecological side, again, there was a flourishing. There was a forest flourishing again. So, you can look at it as a story of loss. We're losing the species, but you can also look at it as a story of regrowth. We may be living in an environment that we never thought was possible or that we never predicted, but there's a process of regrowth and life blooming again. So there's that side. And then from the more human perspective that or our experience of loss, that I think part of climate change adaptation will come from coping with these negative impacts, the ones like our caller that we just had, where you see these frightening impacts that are affecting your life or your community, your neighbors, but then also looking for where are there new opportunities that we can embrace. And that's part of, you know, any kind of grief process, whether it's about a tree or the environment or the home that you know.
A lot more to talk about with Lauren Oakes. Her book is called In Search of the Canary Tree. We'll talk about her field work coming up. It got fairly grueling, as you might imagine, given some of the spectacular landscapes of Alaska and the near impossibility of getting across them. In Search of the Canary Tree and Lauren Oakes coming back to the Jefferson Exchange in 1:30 with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the environment, the climate, and how it is changing around us and how it affects the creatures around us, the creatures including trees. Lauren Oakes is a conservation scientist at the Wildlife Conservation Society. She became Dr. Oakes in the process of researching the yellow cedar in Alaska, Calotropis nootkatensis, or is it Camiciparis nootkatensis? You decide after you read In Search of the Canary Tree, the story of a scientist, a cypress, and a changing world. You can join the conversation here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Lauren, I want to talk more about the system in which we find the yellow cedar, and particularly in how you find yourself trying to find the yellow cedar. The field work sounds a lot more involved than a simple camping trip.
Yeah, definitely the hardest camping of my life. we're working on the outer coast of southeast Alaska, largely in an area called the West Chichikov-Yacobi Wilderness, which is one of the most remote wilderness areas we have in the country. And the sites were only accessible by boat or plane, but we didn't go back and forth. We basically packed for 10 to 18 days at a time and set up a base camp in some pretty rainy conditions in a temperate rainforest, and then we would kayak to and from sites. And even the process of getting to what was a site was kind of like a geocache GPS wandering, because we had randomly selected sites. You never knew exactly what you were going to get until you got there. So we'd show up on a beach, pull our kayaks up, and, you know, basically walk towards a randomly generated location and then work there, assuming it met all the needs we had.
Which could mean you were climbing to some fairly remote places, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it means you could spend the whole morning paddling and climbing and before you even got to the place where your work began.
And once on the ground, though, I mean, did the groundwork reveal as many surprises as that first flyover where you just were shocked by all the dead trees?
Yeah, I think on the ground, what was most surprising was the density of dead trees, and then also the story of regrowth. And some of our hardest days were in the sites that had not had enough time to fully regenerate and grow into something new. So you'll be walking through a forest. We call them these ones in kind of midlife crisis. They didn't know what they were going to be yet. And you've got a lot of standing dead above you, as well as a really thick understory with conifers regenerating or vaccinium and shrubs taking over. And you're just, you know, pushing through shrub and crawling up and over trees that have fallen down. Those were some of the hardest days, but also the ones that convinced me, okay, there's something here. This isn't just a story of death.
Well, I love that use of the term, the forest being a midlife crisis, which makes us ask a question about the forests more broadly than just the cedars. I mean, does the yellow cedar tend to be the central species in its ecosystem, or are there some notable competitors or trees that it has to be around, for example?
Yeah, Yeah, so actually throughout Southeast Alaska, some of the averages will say that yellow cedar only comprises about 7%, maybe 10% of the forest. So it's traditionally thought of as more rare in the region, and it is in many places, though there are some pockets and areas, particularly on Chichagof, where they are more dense. And they tend to be found with western hemlock or also on kind of more boggy soils, shore pine, where they won't grow as big. They do really well on the well-drained soils where their roots can take hold and they can grow into these, you know, big, beautiful trees.
So it sounds like the terrain was very different. Were the surroundings very different plot to plot? Or could you pretty much figure that within a few feet of a yellow cedar, you're going to see a couple of other things that were part of the ecosystem usually?
Yeah, there's certainly a yellow cedar community, both of conifers and then in the understory, smaller plants, but there's a range of habitat in where they thrive. So sometimes we were working on, a slanted, more rocky, well-drained slope, and we had kind of thresholds for what percentage of slope was even manageable for us to handle in our field work. And then sometimes we were in, you know, more boggy soils where the trees might be smaller, but, you know, we'd traipse through muskegs to get there, and it was all kind of where we ended up based on this random location.
Lauren Oakes is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, In Search of the Canary Tree. We have an email here from John and Eugene who writes, if the trees do not die, is this a sign that the trees were genetically more tolerant of the changing conditions and therefore the new breed of yellow cedar? Also, are yellow cedars moving into formerly uninhabitable for them territory?
Yeah, great questions. So the first one on genetics, there's actually research underway to try and address that question. Is there some genetic advantage the survivors have? We don't know. The thought is that, again, it's based on microclimate where they and the conditions that each individual established themselves in and called home when they germinated. But that is an outstanding research question that others are working on in the area. And in terms of the second, are they moving? I think that's a question for not only yellow cedar, but other species that are impacted. Can the rates of, you know, colonization be faster than the rates of climate change? And this is a particularly slow-moving, slow-to-regenerate species. There have been some studies where people in Southeast Alaska have planted further north. So there's some experimental sites in around Yakutat, I think, which is north of where I was working, to look at could they survive and be planted further north. And so far, I think the results on that are kind of underway.
Well, you mentioned that they're a long-lived species and slow to regenerate. I mean, so are they slow in growth, too? I mean, after 40 years, is a yellow cedar not going to be terribly impressive, for example?
Yeah, for sure. They're slow in growth as well. The rings of them, it's beautiful, and that's part of what makes the wood so coveted, is there's this incredibly tight rings, and it's also obviously this rich golden color. But that's also partly influenced by the sites and the soils where they're in, and you'll find some trees, you know, on better drained soils that are growing a little bit faster per year. But again, this is a really tight rings.
Right. One of the strengths of the book, though, is you get us thinking not just about the yellow cedars, but about forest ecosystems in general. And you bring up some terms that, you know, in 30 years of covering forests in this region, hadn't heard about before, like the reverse J of old growth forest is a really interesting idea. What does that refer to?
Yeah, so the reverse J is the idea that you'll have in a healthy forest community, you'll have a lot of small trees that, as the forest develops, some will die off, and eventually they create a cohort of the large ones that you'll see, these kind of iconic monumental trees. And so in order to get to that healthy forest composition, it looks like a reverse J on a graph. You've got a lot of these little guys, and then that slowly decreases up to the wise old elders or the big ones. So that was something that I looked for both in my data. Where do you see a healthy, what looks like a reverse J, a healthy cohort across ages? And also in reality, I was constantly looking for a forest to see, in the forest to see, do we have a cohort of yellow cedars coming up?
All right, it's worth people to look at, even if, you know, whatever they want to do with the book, but to look for a chart about the reverse giant old-growth forest, it really is illustrative of what goes on out in the landscape there. In addition, you know, there are lots of other people that we really haven't talked about that you talk to in this book and learn a lot of things from, particularly some profound stuff from one of your colleagues, Greg. He compares yellow cedars to marbled murrelets and elephants. What's the similarity he sees there?
Yeah, so it's the idea that some species will regenerate well and have lots of offspring, like mice are a good example, right, or rabbits, and then others that put a lot of their energy into few offspring. And so these are R-selected or K-selected species. And what we've seen in terms of how we manage is that people do a really good job in managing, and this is what he argues, and I agree, people tend to do a better job in managing the species that produce a lot. So if you look at, say, for example, you know, fish management, where they're in Alaska, where they're returning on a 2 or 3 year cycle, there's a large cohort each year. We're doing a pretty good job. There's obviously some species in some places where that's not true, but just as a general concept. The other side is look at like elephants, where we're struggling to manage the human impact on them. These are, you know, again, longer-lived species that produce fewer offspring. And so a tree is the same way, and potentially humans could be considered the same.
It's an amazing comparison, though, because it puts plants and animals in the category together in how we treat them as human beings, that if they grow fast, we're happy with them. But if they need a long time to get to where they're going, they're not of such value to us. And as he points out, then we end up substituting youth for age.
Yeah, and it also speaks to management, right? Like it's easier to have a 2 year, a 3 year, a 4 year, a 10 year management plan than to think out what do we do on 30 year or 40 year or 50 year time scale, or, you know, on terms of climate change, everything tends to be modeled to 2100. How do we think on that time scale?
Well, so in the case of yellow cedars, then, I mean, are there some species, plant or animal, that grow or grow better when they die? I mean, are there beneficiaries of the yellow cedars not doing so well?
Yeah, so certainly one of the things I observed was a transition from some of these mosses and bryophytes and the kind of plant life that you would think of in your dreamy temperate rainforest with sponge floor and all of that. All of those kind of characteristics. Anyway, there's a transition there to more shrubs and vaccinium, blueberries and enzisia as the trees die. And those are plants that can take advantage of the light that comes into the forest floor as the canopy opens up. And there were certainly people on the in the community that I interviewed who, hunters, for example, who would choose to hunt in those areas because the forage seemed to be better and the hunting seemed to be better for deer.
Ah, okay. So there are reasons for people to get interested in ecosystems that no longer include the yellow cedar. But so here again, we end up talking about things that are changing because they lived on sort of a narrow edge of conditions that don't necessarily exist in quite the same way anymore. I mean, it seems like there are lots of threshold species out there, aren't there?
Well, I'd say there's a threshold for every species. Mm-hmm. And the bigger question is, do we know them? In this one, you know, there's a very clear physiological vulnerability these trees have. So being exposed to this cold snap at -5 Celsius is they have a different vulnerability than any other conifer in Southeast Alaska. So the same, you know, will hold true for fish in streams. What's a threshold of a temperature that a fish can reproduce under? And again, I think we're wondering what will be the human threshold.
Indeed. So this brings us back to the point of it's too late. I mean, we can't undo climate change today. It has happened, you know. So we're seeing effects of it, as again is backed up by the National Climate Assessment delivered 5 days ago. But, for example, we had the Fish and Wildlife Service forensics lab for the whole country is just a few blocks away from the studio. The director visits from time to time. We've talked to him twice now about elephants because they deal with a lot of poaching cases. He doesn't think things look good for elephants. I wonder how you think about how things look at the moment for yellow cedars.
I think that we'll continue to see it spreading in parts of Southeast Alaska and British Columbia. There is research underway by another colleague of mine, Brian Buma, to do an assessment across the whole range. And again, because of some of the conditions, likely because of some of the conditions where they, when they originally established, at least on a shorter term scale, I think down in Oregon and in Washington, they will still live on. But when you start looking forward, I think we'll see a more fragmented population on larger timescales.
A couple of details of your field work that I want to get in before we have to say goodbye here, which was number one, how much weight did any of you lose? And number two, how bad did any of you smell after 2 weeks out in the woods?
Pretty bad. Yeah, I eventually ended up using my belt that also carried my gun to help keep my pants up. And I had a field technician, Odin Miller, who was 6'4", and he dropped about 15 pounds, and that was still, I mean, we were spooning butter into our food. We weren't skimping.
All right, it's an amazing...
How bad did we smell? Pretty bad.
Yeah, okay, we'll leave it at that. There's a lot of interesting stuff in the book. I mean, the interrelationships between people and creatures and people and people goes far beyond the science that Lauren Oakes collected along the way, which is voluminous in itself. The book is called In Search of the Canary Tree, The Story of a Scientist, a Cypress, and a Changing World. Lauren, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.